The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. You're listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. We have the Book Nook coming up for you. And this past Monday, on Memorial Day, it was the 100th birthday of President John F. Kennedy. And we're going to be talking about JFK in the Book Nook today. My guest will be Tom Oliphant. And he and Curtis Wilkie have just published a book called The Road to Camelot, Inside JFK's Five-Year Campaign. That's coming up on the Book Nook this morning. But first, let's check in with the news from National Public Radio. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Thomas Oliphant. He joins us on the telephone from, where are you, sir?
I'm in Rappahannock County, Virginia, taking one day off from the tour.
All right. Well, you've just published a book, and it's quite a timely one because I believe earlier this week, we marked what would have been the 100th birthday of our President John F. Kennedy, isn't that right?
On Monday.
Uh-huh. On Memorial Day. And you have just published a book. You and Curtis Wilkie wrote this book together. It's called The Road to Camelot, Inside JFK's Five-Year Campaign. And Kennedy, of course, has been written about so much, and yet it seems that this particular subject really hadn't been covered, had it?
Well, no, is the short answer. It really hadn't been. Our conclusion after a year and a half or two of research and months spent in writing the manuscript was that there is a literal mountain of material about Kennedy that has barely been looked at. History's a funny thing, you know. I think it's the president's daughter, Ambassador Caroline Kennedy, who has said recently that her father's time on the public stage is now slowly but surely becoming part of history. And that's an interesting process because I think it helps us move from the period of contemporary memoir, the recollections of some of his closest associates, into a more detailed area, which is where history takes over. And so it's a transitional phase. I mean, past presidents have all gone through it, you know, Lincoln, all of them. And it's starting to happen with Kennedy. And all we noticed was that there's a ton of material that has barely been examined.
All right, so we've got all this material that is just now being explored, and yet we also have the vanishing of all the people who knew him.
That's right. It's funny you should bring that up, because while we were working, you know, we knew most of them over the last 40 years very well, and have talked about that time with virtually all of them. But we did lose a few while we were working who fortunately had a little time to spend with us. The pollster Lou Harris, one of the key members of the Irish Mafia, Dick Donahue, Ted Sorensen, they've passed away just in the last few years, or last year in the case of Lou Harris. And we are just about to the point where everybody is gone. The one exception who could not have been more helpful and gracious with us, is the president's youngest sibling, Ambassador Jean Kennedy Smith, as in Steve Smith's widow. And but that's about it. And so now we're hoping that people are going to start to pay attention to the documentary record. I mean, in terms of the stuff that's available at research libraries. And it turns out to be huge and, in our opinion, just barely examined.
John F. Kennedy took a very different approach to running for president. He got quite an early start, which was rather unusual, wasn't it?
Yes, and it meant that we had to spend a lot of time researching. Kennedy, in all of his campaigns, especially his first one for Congress in 1946, and his first one and his one for the Senate in 1952, became a devotee of the idea that in a campaign, you always start very, very early, and you emphasize the people, recruiting people who aren't big shots. It's hard to look at Kennedy this way initially, because, you know, we know how it ended, and he really was president and all the rest of it, but he was not an insider, he was an outsider. And his emergence, first as a national figure, then as a presidential candidate, and finally as president, it wasn't preordained, and he was by no means the strongest potential candidate running in 1960, and so he was off. He had made the decision by late 1956. But he'd been seeking office, national office, already for a year because he gave it the old college try to be on Adlai Stevenson's ticket in 1956. And he was going to be, the one thing he understood from the beginning, was that the only way he could be nominated was from the outside in, that no deliberative national convention would turn to him. Because he was seen, probably correctly, as often an indifferent Democrat who showed flashes of independence from his party. He hadn't really done much as a legislator. His views on the major issues of the day were largely unformed. And so the only way somebody like that could get started and accumulate support was to begin very, very early, and that's exactly what Kennedy did.
My guest is Tom Oliphant. We're talking about the book that he just published with Curtis Welkie called The Road to Camelot, Inside JFK's Five-Year Campaign. I know it might come as a shock to you, Tom, but we probably have some listeners out there who don't know much about the history of the presidential elections in the 1950s. Let's just give them a little brief capsule here. In 1952, the World War II hero, General Dwight Eisenhower, was elected as a Republican. He ran against Adlai Stevenson from Illinois. And then in 1956, the popular incumbent Eisenhower ran again for reelection, and he ran against Stevenson again. And at that 1956 convention for the Democrats, John F. Kennedy really wanted to be named on the ticket. He wanted to become the vice presidential candidate. His father was very much against it. Let's talk about this. Let's talk about that vice presidential ambition in 1956, how Kennedy kind of rebelled against his father.
Well, don't all sons at some point? You know, Kennedy, it's important not to see Kennedy as unique, but one of the things we discovered in our research is that the influence of his father has been greatly overstated over the years. Clearly the money was there. I mean, Kennedy did fundraising also, but the money from his family was obviously something that, he couldn't have run without it. But his father was a politician, don't forget, of the old school, the deliberative brokered national convention, where a handful or at least no more than 15 or 20 people could almost decide who should be a presidential nominee. And Kennedy was part of the transition to a different system. What we kept discovering was that his father's advice or urgings, I mean, he could be overbearing. He was always certain, and he bombarded his son with a steady stream of do this, don't do that contact. But what we kept discovering was that Kennedy almost never agreed with him and almost never followed his father's advice, whether it was which primaries to enter. Even his approach to national politics was at variance with his father's view. So this, and just for perspective, we looked at this phenomenon going all the way back to the beginning in 1946 and then in 1952 for the Senate. And again, the idea that his father was pulling strings and manipulating the son is we decided it's ridiculous. Not just Kennedy, but also his younger brother Robert, constantly either ignored or rejected their father's advice.
Robert really comes through in this account that you've written as a fierce defender, almost an attack dog for his brother.
Well, the word, you know, that was coined in the 1950s, and it stuck with Bob Kennedy really all the way through his life, which he hated, by the way, was the word ruthless.
Mm-hmm.
What we found was a young man who was in the process of becoming the Robert Kennedy the country got to know in the mid-1960s and up toward his own murder, is not generally seen in the 1950s. Well, he was young, he was brash, overbearing at times, it's a cartoon picture, and the real Robert Kennedy, we decided, is much more interesting than that, precisely because he was in the process of becoming.
Mm. I'm Vic McInnes. It's the Book Nook, and I'm talking to Tom Oliphant about the book The Road to Camelot, Inside JFK's 5-Year Campaign. The Book Nook will continue right after this. You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. My guest is Tom Oliphant. His book is The Road to Camelot, Inside JFK's 5-Year Campaign. He wrote it with Curtis Welke. And the two of you worked together for many years, didn't you, in the newspaper world?
40 years, believe it or not. We sometimes argue about when we met, whether it was in one of the early primaries in 1972 or on the floor of the Democratic Convention in 1968, but that's how far we go back.
In this book, we look at the flaws and the strengths of John F. Kennedy as a candidate, and what a different world. I loved your exacting coverage of the primary process, and it was so different then to have these focused primaries just in a few states. There were, what, a dozen of them or 16 primaries that were actually things where they would campaign, and there were some very crucial ones because of the other potential candidates, Wisconsin and West Virginia in particular.
That's right. It was a different time, and it was a changing time. And Kennedy caught the essence of that change, and that was, for want of a better phrase, a desire on the part of voters to have their voices count. There'd been little hints of it earlier in the decade, but it was Kennedy who based his entire strategy on, first of all, sweeping the primaries. There was no room for a defeat because he was such, I won't say insignificant, but he was not a seen as a powerful figure when all this began. He hadn't accomplished much. His views weren't generally known. People in the party, were suspicious of his loyalty. The only way he could persuade them otherwise was to go out in the country and, first of all, win primaries, which had never really counted much in the process. They were used almost as a kind of advisory thing in deciding who should be presidential nominees. Kennedy made the primaries dispositive. And then he figured out a way to leverage the support that he got in the primaries in the states that didn't hold them. And he was the first national candidate to really develop a way to dive into the complicated mess of caucuses and county conventions and state conventions that produced delegations to the national convention. And by and large, what he did was something no one had ever done before, and that is he used polls. He was the first presidential candidate to have a pollster on his staff. He found a young Lou Harris at the end of 1957, believe it or not. Mm. It was when the retainer agreement was signed. And Lou Harris was in the field by early in 1958. And Kennedy often used Harris's polling in states that didn't connect primaries to make the point to party people in those states that he was a strong candidate and that they should consider him. So while it's true, I guess, that the 16 primaries at most produced a third of the delegates to the convention, there were many more whose selection was heavily influenced by Lou Harris's polls.
One of his greatest perceived obstacles, and I remember it well because I'm a product of the parochial schools.
Oh, boy.
I can remember that election where the nuns would smile approvingly and we would chant, "Kennedy, Kennedy, he's our man. Nixon belongs in a garbage can." and they would applaud the nuns. And his Catholicism was thought to be a significant impediment. They all look back to 1928, didn't they?
Yeah. Well, you know, the first thing that we discovered about Kennedy and religion, and you're absolutely right to underline its importance, but the first thing we discovered was, again, how early Kennedy went to work on this alleged problem. It was in the very early months of 1956 when he was just beginning to flirt with the idea of getting on Adlai Stevenson's ticket. And so he researched the issue. His then very young aide, I think he was 26 at the time, Ted Sorensen, did a study of Catholic voting in the United States, tried to deal with the Al Smith hangover, which still exists. I mean, back in those days, it was almost people repeated it without examining it, this idea that it was a severe handicap. But what Kennedy discovered was that it, instead of being just a handicap, his religion was a two-edged sword. Yes, there were parts of the country where he was absolutely unacceptable because of his religion. But there were also parts of the country where his religion was a huge plus, as witness the chants in your parochial school.
Mm-hmm.
And he was helped very greatly here by Lou Harris's polling. We discovered all kinds of surveys that Harris did that showed this. First of all, Harris said that his data proved that the more Kennedy actually talked about his religion, the better he did. And that one of the problems that Al Smith had not dealt with in 1928 was that he it's not that he hid his religion, it's just that he didn't talk about it.
Uh-huh.
And so people were free to let their prejudices roam freely. Kennedy, beginning in 1956, started to talk about it. And what Harris noted was just that the more he talked about it, the less of a problem it was. In the end, I think what Lou, what Mr. Harris, bless his heart, argued from his data was that maybe a quarter of the population cited religion as an important factor in deciding who they were for, but that of that number, maybe about 10% of the country was firmly unwilling to consider a Catholic in that period. But the judgment that was that Kennedy could work with that because there were all kinds of Catholics in the country then, not quite as large a population as there is today, but there were many, not particularly partisan, living in these new places in the 1950s called suburbs, that were willing to consider Kennedy precisely because he was Catholic. I think the way the history has been told up until now, people say that Kennedy had this dramatic appearance in Houston in the general election in 1960, and it was dramatic, by the way. But he had been saying these things at that point for more than 4 years. When the votes were finally tallied, the post-election studies that we consulted all seemed to show that while his religion mildly depressed his popular vote total, it was a significant help to his electoral college total.
Mm.
You know, back in those days, there was still a relatively solid South for the Democrats, for obvious reasons. It was in the northern industrial states where it appeared that Kennedy's religion mostly helped him.
Well, that solid South was already eroding. Eisenhower had won a half a dozen states in the previous election. Of course,
yes, and it was partly, or actually, I should change that, mostly because of Lyndon Johnson being on the ticket. Kennedy held it together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he won 6 of the 11 one-time Confederate states, Texas, Arkansas, Louisiana, North and South Carolina, and Georgia. Pretty good.
Uh-huh.
Johnson was a huge help. The partisan habits of the South at that time, combined with Lyndon Johnson's presence, were enough to give Kennedy those, as I say, those 6 states, plus half of one of the states that was that had these independent electors put forward by segregationists. Alabama, he split.
Mm.
But on the other hand, as I said a second ago, his religion probably was a positive factor in the larger northern industrial states, particularly in the Midwest and Northeast.
The book is The Road to Camelot, Inside JFK's 5-Year Campaign. Tom Oliphant joins us. He wrote it with Curtis Wilkie, and it's just come out here as we mark the 100th anniversary of the birth of John F. Kennedy. That win in the West Virginia primary, a lot of things contributed to it, including lots of cash distributed to county sheriffs in West Virginia. That's just kind of the way they did things back then. And the Catholicism issue kind of got put to rest after he won that primary in a lot of ways. He kind of delivered a knockout punch to it. But he had a lot of other issues. One of his rivals for the nomination was Senator Hubert Humphrey from Minnesota, who was very strong on civil rights issues. We just had the Emmett Till murder in 1955. Civil rights was very much in the forefront.
Yes.
Kennedy was perceived as being very weak on civil rights. He really didn't even know any black people.
Right.
And we had the weakness in farm issues. He was perceived by people out in rural areas as not being a friend of the farmers. And we had the opportunity a couple of times to have the late Senator George McGovern on the program, and he told us one time about a conversation he had with Jack Kennedy right before Kennedy was getting ready to give a speech at the Corn Palace in South Dakota. And Kennedy read his speech to McGovern, and McGovern said, "No, no, that's all wrong." And he set him straight. And I understand that you got to know Senator McGovern quite well, too.
Oh, yes. And he was a very important part of Kennedy's really self-education project after 1956 to get rid of these impressions of him. You know, part of it was like his problem with civil rights. He just had no background whatsoever. And then secondly, on substance, Kennedy had a fiscal conservative streak in him. And he had voted a couple of times earlier in the decade with the Eisenhower administration on some farm issues that, you know, Eisenhower had no trouble winning in the Midwest. But in the Democratic Party, some of Kennedy's votes were seen as hostile. And, you know, when they called the roll in 1956 on the vice presidential nomination, when Adlai Stevenson threw it open, the guy who won, Estes Keefover, just clobbered Kennedy in the Midwest. And Kennedy got the message, and one of the things we discovered about him, or learned again about him, was how he was willing to learn. Mm-hmm. And we found all kinds of records of his discussions with farm state Democrats after 1956, where he let himself get educated. And by 1960, it was very hard to make the case that Kennedy was hostile, particularly to smaller farmers, which, you know, they still existed in those days. And but it was initially a real problem, and a good example of how Kennedy's background before he started running for president was hardly conducive to victory.
One of my favorite things about the book is you pull back the curtains and you show us little snippets of what these politicians actually thought of one another. For instance, Adlai Stevenson couldn't stand his running mate who was stuck onto the ticket with him in 56. And then in 1960, the giant donkey in the room, the unannounced candidate who really didn't like JFK and ended up becoming his running mate. Let's talk about Lyndon Johnson. What an amazing guy.
Well, yes. You know, there isn't much question in our minds after the research we did that Johnson rabidly wanted to be president and wanted to win in 1960, but he could not bring himself to run in any of the primaries. And I'll leave it to psychologists to say if it was a fear of losing or whether it was a more rational judgment that outside of the South, he just did not have enough appeal. But Johnson is best thought of as the candidate he was in 1960. I mean, in many respects, the West Virginia primary, for example, was a kind of fraud in the sense that Humphrey was not viable at that point, having lost in Wisconsin. But he was being propped up by people who were trying to stop Kennedy, mm-hmm. one of whom was Lyndon Johnson. I mean, you talked a second ago about all that money that flowed into the state and then to the county sheriffs, especially for political purposes down the stretch of that primary. But a lot of the money, there was a lot of Johnson money that came into West Virginia to try to stop Kennedy. And in fact, one of the issues Kennedy used in West Virginia was that Humphrey really wasn't his opponent, and that he was running against these dark forces that were trying to stop him. And he wasn't totally wrong in that point of view. And so, you know, Johnson emerged eventually the kind of candidate who was hoping for a brokered convention.
Mm-hmm.
And that required somehow preventing Kennedy from winning the nomination on the first ballot. And, of course, all of Kennedy's work, not just in Wisconsin and West Virginia, but all over the country, was designed to accumulate enough support to give him a commanding position on the first or at least the second ballot. And so Johnson, is best seen in 1960 as Kennedy's opponent. And in fact, when the year began, there was a pretty broad consensus, for example, in the national press, that Johnson was the most likely nominee.
You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. My guest is Tom Oliphant. He's the co-author with Curtis Welke of The Road to Camelot, Inside JFK's Five-Year Campaign. I'll continue my conversation with Tom right after this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Today my guest is Tom Oliphant. He's the co-author with Curtis Welke of The Road to Camelot, Inside JFK's Five-Year Campaign. We talked about some of JFK's weaknesses on the campaign trail, and one that noted publicly very much came to a lot more attention years later. 20 years ago, I had a guest on this show who had written a book called The Dark Side of Camelot. His name is Seymour Hersh. You give him some credence. You quote from him in your book. We had a real weakness, a terrible secret weakness in that president, Kennedy, his roving eye.
Given the nature of American society at the time, Kennedy was hardly unique. But you're absolutely right. And, you know, Cy Hersh, whom both Curtis and I know and revere, but we also used Sorensen,
mm-hmm.
who eventually, after it was all over later in life, talked about this subject. My own bias is I find a lot of support for the substantive position of so what.
Uh-huh.
But where I think Kennedy should be faulted is that his conduct, which I think could be called reckless, risked millions of people by then who were, whose hopes and dreams were caught up in his candidacy. And to be behaving like this was really risky in the extreme. Kennedy wasn't unique. There were other people who ran that year who had complicated or compartmentalized private lives. But I always thought Sorensen was the most perceptive eventually in saying that what was being risked were all these people who were for him. Back then, you tended, I remember that culture vividly because I came out of it. You didn't write about somebody's private life unless there was some kind of public explosion, number one, or number two, it ended up on a police blotter.
Mm-hmm.
And the result was a lot of private lives weren't written about, not just Kennedy's. But from the standpoint of today, it's something that's lurking there, and you begin to see just how reckless it was, and there's no getting around that. He was lucky that nothing surfaced at the time, though people looked. A lot of people looked. That was a period in our history when private lives, as I say, were left alone unless they became part of a public forum. You know, we didn't even write about people who drank heavily unless, you know, they were like impaired in public or something.
Huh.
Whether that's right or wrong, that's what the system was, and Kennedy was enabled by that system But still, it was very risky, and in hindsight, irresponsible.
Well, we've certainly come a long way, and I think
we've
been traveling backwards based on the allegations that were made during this last campaign against the man who's now our president. Apparently, the stuff just doesn't stick anymore. But I don't want to pass up the opportunity to talk about my favorite political figure from the 20th century, a man named Richard Nixon, who was Kennedy's opponent in 1960. What an amazing personality.
And you know, it's as somebody who covered him during my 40 years in the daily newspaper world, he's endlessly fascinating. I never get enough Nixon.
I don't either.
But it was an interesting perspective for Curtis and me to see him in the context of the race against Kennedy. You know, this was the campaign where Nixon made probably the fatal mistake of running the whole thing himself, a mistake he didn't repeat in later campaigns. But it really was fascinating to see him as an opponent. And in some respects, I think, you know, the loss was so narrow. We tend to forget that Nixon had a very powerful set of arguments to make that year and made them pretty forcefully. It was continuity, someone you can trust at a time of intense Cold War tensions, knowledge and experience. He came to this race with great strengths. I think the political weakness in 1960 was that far more than Eisenhower, Nixon was seen as a partisan, divisive figure. That was the problem even then. And so he tended not to have the kind of appeal in the middle among people who called themselves moderates, among people even who weren't particularly partisan or were actually independent. And that political weakness is the reason he didn't come close to Eisenhower's vote totals.
I am going to give a heads up to our mutual friend, the eminent journalist Ken Bodie, that we have had this conversation. And whenever I see Ken, he's always got some great stories, stories from the trenches. And I'm thinking that maybe if you could tell us a Ken Bodie story, that he might be amused. Do you have a good one?
Well, let me think. We share an affinity with, I mean, one of the things that I love about Ken, and Curtis does too, is that Ken has never been afraid of politics or seen it as somehow beneath him. He actually loves it. His views may be progressive, But the real point is his passion and love for the game. And we share a friendship with one of these classic Massachusetts operatives who went on to do national political work, a guy named Ed Jesser out of Boston, one of the most delightfully foul-mouthed political people I have ever associated with. And it's a hallmark of Ken's journalism that he had a natural affinity for the people who worked in the trenches. And that meant he could literally understand what was going on. It wasn't all media and image and sound bites with Ken. Whether he was writing, as he did so magnificently so many times in the New Republic, or his role on the air as NBC's top political person, particularly in the 1980s. You know, it's been rare that there have been people on national television who actually understood the game. I mean, Tim Russert is one who comes to mind, but Ken is another. There are not enough of them.
Mm. Which brings me to wonder, I'm reminded by reading your book that I had Karl Rove on a few years ago for his book about William McKinley. And, and William McKinley also spent about 4 years where he didn't seek the nomination. He was waiting until the next election cycle, just like JFK did. And I was reminded of Karl Rove's book, Talking to You. He talks a lot about the favorite sons, which is something that we've kind of forgotten about. And I'm wondering, Carl, of course, I talked to him before the election, and he wasn't fond of the candidate Donald Trump. And now that we have President Donald Trump, what similarities do you see between John F. Kennedy and Donald Trump?
Well, none, in a word. None, whether substantively or politically. However, Kennedy would be probably wryly amused if you told him that what Kennedy did in 1960, which was to introduce American politics to voters, winning from the outside in, there's a direct line from what Kennedy did as the first outsider to win. There's a direct line that leads from that to the Trump candidacy last year. Not the same kind of campaign, not even close, but the idea that it's possible to organize outside the party system, in effect, it really begins with Kennedy. And you know, one of the results of democracy is, you know, you need to live with the result, and that people can be quirky and funny. And American presidential politics is very much complicated by the fact that our voting participation is so abysmal compared to other countries that it is possible for weird things to happen. Usually they're confined to nomination politics, but the fact is the Kennedy approach to this game is in the direct ancestor line of Trump.
Well, thank you for that.
No accident, by the way, that important managers ever since Kennedy, beginning with Barry Goldwater in 1964, very carefully studied what Kennedy did, and in most cases tried to emulate it.
We get some eerie visions reading your book. At one point you talk about John Connally, who went on to become the governor of Texas and was in the car with Kennedy in Dallas on that terrible day and was also shot but not killed. Connally
badly wounded.
He hated Kennedy. And here they are.
Well, and in fact, it's hard to identify people as the right hand of Lyndon Johnson, but John Connally was one of Johnson's most important people in trying to stop Kennedy and then win the nomination for Johnson in a brokered convention. And as it moved toward its climax, as this amazing melodrama unfolded that put Johnson on the ticket, Connally was so furious at what had happened that he just left Los Angeles and didn't participate for the rest of the campaign. He took a walk.
And then we have that eerie situation where the candidate, vice presidential candidate, Lyndon Johnson is in his native Texas with Lady Bird, and they go to Dallas, and it's a terrible kind of preview, isn't it?
Well, in a way, yes. What happened at the Adolphus Hotel, the famous hotel in Dallas, I think it's the Friday before the election, probably had something to do with the final result there. Kennedy's margin was only about 40,000 votes. But to continue the analogy, the very conservative congressman who organized that protest that got so ugly that night in Dallas, just as Johnson was arriving back in the state from this train trip he had taken through the South that many, many of us think was very important to the, to the result in the South. But that ugly incident was, the guy who organized it was a congressman. He has since died, named Bruce Alger. And right wing maybe doesn't do justice to Bruce Alger's politics, but he was also the guy who, just a few weeks before President Kennedy was murdered, organized another demonstration in Dallas to protest the appearance there of the by then UN ambassador Adlai Stevenson. During which Stevenson was spat on by some of the it was an extremely ugly thing. And the thing with Johnson was also ugly, but I tell you, one little discovery we made in viewing the oral histories of some of the people who were with Johnson that night is that, you know, Johnson, say what you will, was no dummy. And from the moment as he approached the hotel that he realized that something kind of bad was about to happen, he milked it. He made sure that his and his wife's entry into the hotel, that it took almost 45 minutes to get from the hotel entrance to the elevators. And what he was doing was making sure that the reporters and the television cameras got a huge dose of this demonstration, his instinct being that it would look bad, and it did look bad. So give Johnson credit. In almost every situation, he understood the politics completely. And the incident actually, we think, had something to do with the late movement toward Kennedy in Texas.
LBJ was a savvy one. The book is The Road to Camelot, Inside JFK's Five-Year Campaign. My guest has been Tom Oliphant. He wrote the book with Curtis Wilkie, just published by Simon & Schuster. As we marked the 100th birthday of John F. Kennedy this past week, and I have just enough time to ask you one more question, and this relates back to what little I know about your past history, but I heard a rumor that you were involved in some civil unrest yourself. Weren't you arrested back in 1973, something to do with Wounded Knee?
Indicted. It was one of the Nixon wars, part of the Nixon wars. I had covered a bunch of people who organized a flight of three little planes that dropped food and medical supplies to the American Indian Movement people who occupied the hamlet of Wounded Knee for almost 2 months. And after the food, the supplies were parachuted in there, I got nabbed for participating in a riot and crossing state lines with the intent of fomenting civil disorder. I thought I was covering a story. But indicted, and the case lingered for about 6 months until it was dismissed by Elliot Richardson.
Those were the days, and the name.
Those were the days.
The name Elliot Richardson takes us back to 1973 and the Watergate hearings. And what do you think? Are we going to be having any kind of similar situation politically? Do you have any?
The one thing I think we can sadly be confident of is that the investigations are going to continue for some time. There's enough indication of, if not stonewalling or cover-up, but this isn't resolving itself quickly. Without predicting the eventual outcome, it's pretty clear this is going to be around for a while.
We've had John Dean on the show a couple of times, and I know that he's one of the last remaining people involved in that, and I'm sure he's watching this avidly.
Yes, and participating as an analyst, and he's a very good one. You know, this is not the guy who was the chief operating officer of the Watergate cover-up. He's one person who was really changed by his experience. And I always pay attention to his analysis.
Well, Tom, we really appreciate your time today.
It was my pleasure, and thanks for having me.
The book is The Road to Camelot, Inside JFK's Five-Year Campaign. And my guest has been Thomas Oliphant. He co-wrote the book with Curtis Wilkie, his colleague for many years, writing for the newspaper in Boston. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.